Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on AM 1240 WGBB in Freeport, New York, and live streaming on the web at am1240wgbb.com. And it's time for a segment called Dave's Got Guests, and I do have one single guest and a rather singular guest at that. Now, a lot of people know him from TV, although not necessarily on some level by his face, because he was in quite a bit of different makeup. At least in one particular program. Gosh, I'm being very vague about this intro, but let me get specific. This person is also a theater person who has done quite a bit of Shakespeare. He's currently in King Lear, and that's running through April 17th at San Diego Rep. His name is Armin Shimerman, kind of an unlikely name for a theater and television star, but this is exactly what he is. Sci-fi people certainly will know who he is from Star Trek Deep Space Nine, where he played Quark, and also Buffy the Vampire Slayer, where he was Principal Snyder, but he doesn't sound quite so evil in person. So please welcome Armin Shimerman to the neighborhood. Armin, are you there?
Yes, Dave, here. Thank you for the very nice introduction.
Oh, you're very welcome, and thanks for being here with us in the neighborhood. How's King Lear going?
Doing quite well. Our houses are very large. We've had nice reviews. The audience, we had a talk back last night, and we had a dear man in the audience who was in tears after seeing the play. He was that moved. It's a very moving play, but obviously this gentleman... he had never seen Lear before, and this gentleman obviously was very taken with it.
Well, that's cool. By the way, the production is featuring the artistic director of San Diego Rep, Sam Woodhouse, is playing Lear. And Todd, is it Salovey or Salovey is director?
Salovey. Director.
Is the director. And yes, by the way, the reviews, I don't know. I was going to ask if you read reviews or not, but obviously
I tend not to read the reviews until after the show is over. But people have been telling me they've been good, so
well, yes,
I'll go on their word.
The Union Tribune called you nimble, and other nice words about your performance as the Fool. Is this the first time you played that role in King Lear?
Yes, it is, although I came very close to playing this part in New York in the late 70s, early 80s. There was going to be a production of King Lear with Richard Burton,
and
it was going to be produced by Alexander Cohen. That production never actually happened because Mr. Burton, and I totally understand it now, Mr. Burton only didn't want to do matinees. He only wanted to do six performances a week. Alex wanted to do eight. That's understandable as well.
Right.
They couldn't agree on seven, and so the production never happened. And in that production, I was going to play the Fool as well.
Wow. And did you catch the Lear that they did just last season? I think Christopher Plummer was in it on Broadway.
No, I didn't, since I'm located in Los Angeles, I didn't get a chance to see it. I have worked with Mr. Plummer before. We did Henry V at Stratford in Connecticut.
Wow, cool. So you have quite a bit of experience in Shakespeare. I guess the first place to start is asking how playing Shakespeare is different and or the same as playing some of the more modern theatrical works.
Well, first thing, of course, is the language. And the language has to be mastered before you can really approach the roles adequately. Otherwise, the audience is going to be lost. The Elizabethans had a certain way of speaking, more importantly, of writing, and it had something to do with Greek rhetoric. And once you've mastered the principles of Greek or Elizabethan rhetoric, you have a better handle on how to do Shakespeare. I teach that subject to actors around Los Angeles. And I find without that, it's impossible to understand what people are saying. With it, it becomes incredibly easy to understand what the actors are saying and what Shakespeare is writing. He put the words together in a certain way in order for his audiences to see how nimble, if I may use that word, how nimble they were with Elizabethan rhetoric.
So what's like the first bit of advice that you would give an actor specifically? I mean, obviously you're going to say make the words make sense.
Yes.
But what's something that you would tell the actor?
I'll give you a principle.
Yeah.
Absolutely. One of the principles of rhetoric is using what's called antithesis. Antithesis is simply the use of opposite ideas or opposite words. One of the more famous antitheses in Shakespeare is, of course, to be or not to be. Now, what you must do is show the audience the tension between the opposites. Once they begin to hear tension between words and how words are put together, they better understand what it is you're saying. So a modern actor might say, to be or not to be, that is the question. That's totally understandable to us because we've heard that line so many times. But really, a better trained actor would say, to be or not to be. In other words, make the tension between those things more apparent.
Well, actually, that sounded a little bit Shatner-ish.
But... Well, in a sense, Mr. Shatner was a classical actor that came out of Stratford, Canada. Many of the Star Trek actors, Patrick Stewart, Rene Aubergenois, Avery Brooks, Kate Mulgrew, all of them are classically trained actors. And in fact, I've always thought that that Star Trek is looking for classically trained actors for its larger roles.
Okay, I guess that does kind of lead us very directly into the whole Star Trek thing. How did you become Quark?
Well, certainly Quark has a little to do with Richard III, in the sense that before I was Quark, I was another Ferengi called Letek. Letek was perhaps the first Ferengi ever seen by the Star Trek audience. And there's a little bit of Richard III in Letek. You'll see that he has a slight hunch. He sort of limps a little. And my performance as Letek left an impression with the producers at Star Trek. And when they were looking for Ferengi for Deep Space Nine, I certainly was in their mind. And I had some competing to do, some auditioning to do. But eventually they chose me, and I'm very happy that they did.
And was it a question, I mean, after a while, certainly you have all those that latex and that makeup and stuff. Was it a point where when you first started doing the show, it took 3 hours to get into costume, and then they got it down to about 45 minutes? Or was it always 3 or 4 hours to just get to the point to get you on camera?
Well, to get me on camera, you're absolutely right. In the beginning, it was 3 hours, more makeup than costume. And eventually, my makeup lady, a genius, her name is Karen Westerfield, Karen got it down to 2 hours. We never really got it below 2 hours, so every day started with a two-hour makeup job. That was actually quite useful for me because I used the 2 hours to get up, because my calls were often very early in the morning, say 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock in the morning. But more importantly, I'd used the 2 hours to memorize my lines for the day, and get to know the people that I was going to be acting with. Many times the actors that I would do scenes with were also in makeup, and they'd be seated next to me. And if I didn't know them, we'd be able to have 2 hours to get acquainted and form a relationship, which was helpful on screen.
Well, that's pretty cool. Yeah.
So the 2 hours of makeup may sound like a bad thing when you first hear about it, but it was a useful tool to me as the years went by.
Here's something that struck me as kind of surprising. There are all these different Star Trek and Star Trek spinoffs and derivatives, and actors are hired for them, and they come out of the Shakespearean background and not necessarily out of an SF background. But you apparently have even written Star Trek novels. Have you written them, or are they
into the genre? There are certain science fiction actors who do have their novels ghostwritten. I won't mention any names. But Yes, indeed I have. But in my case, I have written 4 novels, and I have written all 4 of them. Certainly in the case of 3 of them, I had the partners, in the first novel, I would say my partner wrote about 50%. But as I began to write more and more of the novels, I began to take on more and more of the responsibility. And indeed, the last novel, which is called Merchant Prince of Capital.
Oh, I'm sorry, I missed that. The last novel is called what?
The last novel is called Merchant Prince, A Capital Offense.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a trilogy of novels, all starting with the title Merchant Prince. But the last one, Capital Offense, I wrote pretty much by myself. I had somewhat of a help for the first maybe 20 pages, and the other 300 pages are all mine.
Did you write other kinds of material before you went into that genre, or... Were you always writing SF even before you became Quark or were acting in any of the Star Treks?
I wasn't much of a writer before then. When I was a child, in my teens, I had done a lot of writing and had gotten 1 or 2 poems published. But writing seemed like an important thing when I was a teenager, and then I was bitten by the bug, and when I went into acting, everything sort of fell by the wayside. And acting became paramount in my life. But while I was sitting in the trailer those long days, all those many years, I began to realize I was wasting my time just watching TV in my trailer. And someone came to me with the idea of writing, and that seemed very pleasant to me, and so I decided to take that up and filled my hours in the trailer and at home by writing, and it's become one of my passions, actually.
And it takes a special kind of imagination. I mean, I've tried to read SF novels, and my mind just doesn't go that way. It is different. It requires this kind of very big universe that's all tied in with all these ganglia, and I just get completely lost after about 50 pages. I mean, do you find that different of trying to write something else?
I do. I write for my novels are usually about one particular subject as opposed to a world.
Mm.
The world in my novels is not as important as the subject matter that I'm dealing with. My first novel had something to do with Elizabethan history, which I'm interested in. My second novel had to do with the media and with religion. And my third novel had to do with a particular political problem that's in the papers even today about enemy combatants and the Bush administration's use of that.
We should also mention that you got a bachelor's in English from UCLA, so you have that background in writing. How did you go from basically that level to being an actor and getting your first gigs, and what did you do to tide yourself over?
It was very easy to go from the English major to acting in Shakespeare because my specialization in English was Shakespeare.
Oh. Yeah.
So, yes, I graduated with a degree in English, but my emphasis was always on Shakespearean studies. And my English professor, Dr. David Rhodes at UCLA, was very kind when I was taking my senior exam in his course. That turned out to be the same day that I needed to audition for the very prestigious Globe Theater, also here in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Rhodes was kind enough to let me miss the test so that I could audition for the theater. I came back and took the test the next day. Don't remember what my grade on the test was, but I certainly passed, and I also got the audition, got the role at the Globe that I had auditioned for. So it was a good week, and between college and my working at the Globe, there was no time between the two. I actually was working at the theater during graduation services at UCLA.
Wow.
What tided me over?
Yeah.
My experiences at the Globe that summer in 1972, I had many actors from New York who were telling me I should move to New York and look into the New York theater, and I was very fortunate. I moved to New York in 1975. In 1976, I was performing with the Public Theater in their production of Three Penny Opera with Raoul Julia.
Oh, my goodness. So that was your first Broadway role in Three Penny Opera?
My first, yes, and I did three others after that.
Which ones?
I went on from there almost immediately to do a production of St. Joan at the Circle in the Square. We did a Broadway show called Broadway by George Abbott. And my final Broadway show was Richard Rogers' musical, I Remember Mama. Mr. Rogers' last song that he wrote, I believe he wrote for me. Mary, hark ye, lend an ear, 'tis I, Armin Shimmerman, begging you to list to Dave's Gone By on WGBB.
Bravo, 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 magnifico, fantastico. Not counting the one that you're in, because actors always say that, but what would be your favorite role, and it doesn't even have to be Shakespearean. But it can be.
It can be. I think my favorite role, because I've done it a number of times now, is probably Claudius from Hamlet.
Oh.
The reason is I now see Hamlet from Claudius's perspective, and so I love doing that role because although most people think of him as a villain, he's really a very complicated man, and I love being able to convince an audience that there's more to Claudius than just what Hamlet says of him.
Oh, I mean, I get that constantly. Like, last night I was seeing the revival of the Glass Menagerie on Broadway. And basically, what do you think of the mother there? I mean, she's, quote-unquote, the monster. She's intolerable. She's this. She's pushy. She's bossy. And I guess maybe I'm older, but I'm seeing up there a woman who's pretty darn desperate and very, very you know, you feel not only sorry for her, but most of the time she's right.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting. You don't get that when you first talk about Glass Menagerie. You say, oh, these poor, you know, poor young
poor
people.
Children, yeah, living with this monster, exactly.
Yeah.
And as you see different productions and you see gifted actors who attempt the roles, they try to convince you of the rightness of their characters. And in fact, in King Lear, if I may make the transition,
sure.
The two, what are usually called the evil sisters,
well,
you
yeah.
listen to what they have to say, they actually are in the right.
Yeah, the only time they get evil is when they strip him of all his, like, his people and his hangers-on. That's
exactly.
when we start to feel like, all right, they're going too far.
And in our production, as well as many, many other productions, one sees that the hangers-on are sort of rowdy people. They're sort of loud, obnoxious. And so...
They're like Falstaffs, you know, times 20 kind of thing.
Exactly. There's a whole bunch of Falstaffs and Ague Cheeks and Toby Belches. And so the sisters, in a sense, are right to say, you know, you've got 100 rowdy people in my house, and I think, what do you need 100 for? We can do it with 50. So there's a sort of sense to what they're saying and a logic and a rightness to what they're saying. It's only after we see where it takes them that we begin to realize that they're not as good of daughters as perhaps they could be. But the truth of the matter is, if we look at parents and children's relationship, especially when parents get older and are in need of special care, sometimes children have a hard time dealing with their older parents, and that's what this play is about.
Well, yeah, I mean, the one thing, and I'm wondering how your production, well, or I should say Todd Salivet's, you said before, Salivet. His production gets around the fact that the thing I could never get is that the whole show hinges on the king making a very rash, silly decision for no reason. It just sort of comes out of nowhere, and, you know, I just never got that. I mean, is there a way that you kind of, or the director, makes that seem realistic?
That is the problem in the play, in the sense that it happens so quickly. People haven't really settled in their seats yet when that decision is made, and a lot of times audiences will not be aware of how rash that decision is. It's a problem. I'm not sure that we solve it completely. It's really a problem in the play. You know, King Lear is perhaps Shakespeare's greatest play, and it's a little presumptuous of me to say, well, Shakespeare made a mistake here, but I think he did. I think he could have given us more of a relationship between Lear and Cordelia before Lear makes this rather stupid mistake.
I agree. And if you want to see how San Diego Rep tries to solve that problem, other problems, and to bring across the world of Shakespeare and King Lear, and you happen to be on the West Coast listening to this show, please, you have until April 17th to catch King Lear, starring Sam Woodhouse in the title role, and, of course, our guest, Armin Shimerman, playing the Fool. And wondering if, as we go, I guess it would be quite appropriate if you can just give us a little, maybe a quote, a little taste of the Fool fooling?
Sure. Let's see. There's a scene in the second act where the Fool, who has been off stage since the first scene in the script, he's not there at all until this scene in the second act. But he sees Lear for the first time. He's dealing with a character who he knows at that moment as Caius. Caius is really Lear's trusted counselor, Kent. But Kent is in disguise, as mm-hmm. many Shakespearean plays, we have a character in disguise. In our production, I sort of recognize Kent, it's sort of a secret between the two of us. But he's talking to Kent when he comes on stage and says, let me hire him too. Here's my coxcomb. Clara, you would best take my coxcomb. Why? Taking one's part that's out of favor. And I can't stop. Smile as the wind sits. I'll catch cold shortly. There, take my coxcomb. Why, this fellow hath banished two of his daughters and done the third a blessing against his will. If you follow him, thou must needs wear my coxcomb. So that's a little part of Lear. Coxcomb, of course, is the hat that, which your viewers can't see, which is the fool's cap And so he's offering the fool's cap to Kent because any man who's following Lear must be a fool.
Yeah, and also we have to explain for the FCC that Coxcomb is a hat and not something, well, I won't even get into that. But anyway, Armin
Shimerman. That's your problem, not mine.
Armin Shimerman, thank you so much for being with us in the neighborhood. Best of luck with King. Oh, and what's up for you after King there, by the way?
I will hopefully get back to writing my next novel, and I'm sure my agents will find me some work on TV ASAP.
I'm sure they will. Thank you so much.